Conscient Podcast. Let me make sure I get the right number. Episode 78, because I just did 77 yesterday. I'm with Milena Drumeva. How's that?
Excellent.
Close enough. Who's a colleague of mine in the soundscape community here in, we're actually in Vancouver, but in Canada and internationally. We met at a conference 3 years ago in Dieburg, Germany, where there was a big gathering and celebration of the World Forum for Acoustic Ecology. And so you can tell us who you are in just a second, but I want to situate us. Today's November 3rd, Wednesday, November 3rd. We're in your backyard. There's this beautiful little fire beside, and it's creating a bit of a bit of a rumble. And since we're soundscape people, we might as well just observe that urban rumble. That's quite beautiful, like a deep rumbling. It must be the harbor,
the port. Yeah, the port. Actually, that's a big issue because the port is expanding, and they currently have a consultation period. Because sometimes, depending on what's going on at the port, there is quite a loud ambient noise. We can hear it all the way up here to Hastings. We're almost at Hastings. That goes on all night, like 24/7. It's partially because of zoning. In my work, I've been really interested in zoning, and right at the corner here on the street, I don't know if you came from that direction or the other direction, but it's the new Ironworks building, which is industrial zoning, basically. So there's a lot of hums and buzzes that actually come from that direction also, even though we're residential, technically.
Well, let's start with, why don't you do a quick introduction, let us know who you are, what you do, and then we'll jump into the idea of radical listening, because you're a specialist in that field, and, well, you know, you and I both work in a similar kind of area, so we could talk a lot about it, but tell us who you are and what you do.
Yeah, I'm Milena Drumeva. I am located in Simon Fraser University in the School of Communication. Also, of course, we're on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Tsleil Waututh and Squamish people, and Kwikwetlem people on the Burnaby Mountain as well. But I'm kind of in Schaefer's old job, or Barry's old job. I'm the new Schaefer.
Oh, good for you. Well, homage to Schaefer.
Homage to Schaefer,
and
yes.
Barry.
Yeah, and Barry, absolutely. Barry created this position, so right. Definitely homage to Barry. I'm the continuing link in our beautiful tradition of acoustic ecology and soundscape studies, and I feel enormously privileged to be in this position and to have the freedom and to be creative with new directions. So I sent you a little bit of information, but just to touch on it, I've had a major project in the last few years called Livable Soundscapes. So that sort of encapsulates my interest in city sound, city urban soundscapes, issues in urban soundscapes, particularly issues that you can discover by listening. They may not be sonic issues per se, but the sound is an indicator of a sort. So I'm really interested in method and approaches, in listening, of course, as a main method. And I would be remiss not to acknowledge the birds that we're hearing around. Actually, my neighbor on this side and I have a whole feeding situation, bird feeder situations going on. So we do have quite a lot of birds. And I have pigeons on my balcony.
And I'm also hearing a bit of a wind chime. I see it there.
There is a bit of a wind chime, yeah. That's right. And we have the resident crows. In the winter, I do give them peanuts in the shell. And sometimes I'll have a whole, crow murder on the banisters here. So it's fun times, but we also do get the occasional migratory birds like woodpeckers and robins and other colorful songbirds. And this is, by the way, totally a result of the pandemic. You know, it's such a cliche because all the acoustic ecologists have talked about how the world stopped and we started listening during the lockdowns and everybody got obsessed with birds. And so I'm just part of the cliche.
But it's true. I remember in the early days of the pandemic, there were on the listserv, the acoustic ecology listserv, people were talking about how things were much more quiet. And
they were.
And people were enjoying the quiet or the relative quiet because other sounds were able to come out from the mass of noise, of traffic and whatever. And you know, of course, that's all part of, you know, acoustic ecology. You're picking up on the tradition of Murray Schafer, but you also have your own practice and your own approach to it. But it all comes down to listening and the many, many ways that we listen with our ears and with our bodies and with... And that's why I'm interested in the idea of radical listening in the sense that I feel that in this moment, in the climate emergency that we're living through and hopefully will survive, there is that deep listening that needs to happen at so many different levels. So what are your thoughts on that, the idea of radicality or of going beyond, you know, what you know or what you're comfortable with?
Well, here are my thoughts. I do spend a lot of time thinking about listening, and I do it professionally. And I'm also not an artist, or I wouldn't define myself as an artist. I'm not a composer, and I'm not a musician in the sense that I wasn't trained in those things. So I really came to acoustic ecology, unlike Barry and Hildegard and a lot of other people, I came to acoustic ecology kind of squarely by way of the social sciences. I was already very attuned to political economy, social struggle, inequality, marginalization, all of those kinds of things. So, and of course, the more meditative aspects of the more reflective aspects of listening. So I've spent a lot of time listening. I've had some good conversations with Hildy about listening fatigue. Every once in a while, I find myself, because in some ways it's almost a habit and a reflex to always be listening attentively and kind of going through this exercise of placing sounds in some kind of ecology or like understanding the meanings and the masking. And but sometimes I feel a fatigue almost, and I have to kind of just live life and tune some things out, you know, like people do.
Well, you listen more than the average person, or you listen more intensely.
Yes.
But that's interesting.
Yeah, so, and then radical. I have been thinking about this since I approached you and then you approached me and your theme, because as an academic, one of the things that I am saddened by the most is when academia becomes a game of currency and discourse becomes a currency, because radical is something that is very fashionable.
Yeah,
and has been for the last little bit. So honestly, the word radical, it makes me feel exhausted already because of the sort of performativity when academia becomes performative. So I'm someone that always wants to return to an authenticity. And listening really helps me that. I feel like just the practice of listening and thinking about listening is a way to keep returning to a kind of authentic, be honest with myself, you know, what am I interested in? Why am I interested in it? It's aside from writing papers and publishing and, you know, things that I have to do for my job. I think there's a higher purpose, and that purpose demands authenticity. I mean, to really focus on what is important because it is important. So,
well, this podcast, I'm looking at the relationship between art and the what I call the ecological crisis, because it's larger than the climate emergency. And I know that there are a number of soundscape artists. You talked about Hildegard Westerkamp, who I interviewed way back in episode 22. Now we're at 78. And other soundscape artists, Annie Matani and others, who are using that practice to express themselves, but also challenge society in terms of where we're at and what we need to do to not only adapt, but survive this particular crisis. So how do you see art practice? I know you're not an artist yourself, but you're teaching artists, you're writing about them, you're helping to produce them. How do you see soundscapes artists in particular, people working with the sonic environment, contributing to an issue like the climate emergency?
Yeah, that's also something that I've been thinking about a lot. And I wouldn't even draw a line between the definitions of artists and, say, scholars or practitioners of sound. Because things like sound walking, methods like approaches like sound walking and listening are common to us all, and they do and often and should, but often do lay the foundation of our work. So I think it's a common threat that we all sort of have to think about. You know, how is our work doing the work of helping in some way the ecological crisis? And I don't know. I also go through ups and downs on that. I think one thing that I'm ready to move way past is raising awareness. I just feel like raising awareness. No, we've been raising awareness. Awareness has been raised. People who want to be aware have been aware for a long time. So it needs to be something else. And I've been thinking a lot about and actually some of my new students, a new postdoc, Callie Santamas, and a colleague here who is a sound artist and a friend, Helena Krobath. She's not an academic. She's basically your working sound artist / designer, sound designer, but someone who has an art practice. And we've talked a lot about futurity and things like speculative creations or speculative fiction, in the sense that Donna Haraway talked about speculative fiction as having a role when you're at the precipice of a big shift. How do you imagine yourself? How do we imagine humanity in this future that is coming at us? I mean, really. And that's not to say that we can't reduce the effects of the ecological crisis, and we shouldn't be working, but there's no stopping something. Something's coming. And so our practice, I really think at this point, needs to be best is oriented to kind of creating imagining a future. Imagining futures rather than just raising awareness. I've been somewhat frustrated with this marriage of art and science, where artists draw data and transform it, and you know, like listening to a petrol leak out of a sunken tanker in the ocean. It's sort of it's sort of the thing that we just talked about. I mean, it's an enormous sense of I can't do anything about that. I'm just witnessing a horrible ecological disaster, but there's nothing that this installation is giving me other than feeling bad that this happened. So, you know, there's a place for positivity as well in this kind of thinking about futurity or speculative sonic fictions. And that's not my term.
It's not a bad term, though. Yeah. Speculative. I mean, I sometimes insert quotes from other episodes, and I was speaking with Diana Liverman, who you probably don't know. She's a scientist in Arizona, but she was saying something similar, and I'll play a quote now from her.
One of the things I look for is for artists and the cultural sector to help us envisage a future that's positive. Mm. I'm not really looking for more. The vision of the apocalypse that science is presenting is hard enough. I'm not sure whether we need to elaborate on what we're saying, but what we're looking for as scientists is ways to have human behavior change so that emissions come down and we're helping the disadvantaged to adapt to climate change, and to the extent the cultural sector can help us imagine those positive futures. That's one of the gaps, I think. We've tended to spend our whole time talking to each other about how bad it is. And I'm always looking for some hope, and I think maybe the Partnership for Hope would be a good place to look.
And so scientists are reaching out to artists, and artists are reaching out to scientists. And sometimes it's the kind of thing you're talking about, let's visualize the data, and there, you know, that there's some merit to that. But the speculative part, and also there's an artist, Jen Ray, who's from Canada but lives in Australia, who talks about preparedness, artistic practice. For instance, people living in the South Pacific are likely to be some of the first people affected, if they're already affected, further affected, you know, evacuations, that kind of thing. How can art play a role in empathizing with people's predicaments? How can there be a real role, a practical role, in moving people forward in terms of collective collecting resources, the moral, spiritual, emotional side of what we're experiencing, community arts, blah, blah, blah. There's lots of practices, and artists are doing that work, but we certainly have to move beyond that sort of, let's raise awareness, because if you raise awareness, like, I'm way over that, too. That's over. That's like 10 years old.
Oh, 20.
But today, yeah. So what are the issues? Well, we think we know what the issues are, but what are the practices today that actually will help? It can help the artist individually, but will help society move forward to deal with this.
So I'll share with you my kind of radical rant.
Aha, radical.
Radical rant. And take it as you will. You know, this is a conversation. So it moves away from sound. But I really do think that I'm so close to sound and listening that, like, those are embedded in me, those sensibilities. But really what I'm going to rant about is more just the general state of the world. And so, to answer your question of what art needs to become, is I think art needs to get on the street, because raising awareness in a gallery is really speaking to the choir. So I mean, I'll leave raising awareness, because we both agree that, you know, the time for that has passed. But I think art needs to revert back to artisan and craft, and in the sense that imagination can lead to crafting things that we will actually need for survival. And I think that, again, this is my radical rant, I think that one of the reasons why we're seeing these unprecedented amounts of anxiety, and, you know, even this new term climate anxiety that we have, which is almost probably about to be defined as a kind of mental health condition, is because we are so profoundly disconnected from our own means of existence. I think we don't work with our hands, we don't make things, we don't take care of our environment. One of the things that I've realized during the pandemic, that we spent a lot of time at home, the things that grounded me was, well, meeting my pigeons, playing with them, doing something for them, like giving them water, some seeds every day, taking care, like being a caretaker for my environment and noticing what's happening around and pruning the bushes and planting and growing food. I mean, seeds for vegetables was one of the first things that, like, toilet paper just disappeared off the shelves because everybody went into their apocalypse mode. You know, I'm gonna grow my own food and, you know, be self-sufficient. But I think that's what we need, and the role of art could be to provide imaginary craft solutions. I wish I could say it more elegantly, but, you know, art needs to become artisan and be on the street and work directly to that envisioned future in which we are going to be in the throes of an ecological crisis, not anticipating it and talking about it.
Well, that is, I mean, I'm glad you said that, because it's a radical idea in this sense, and I know the word radical is a bit tired, but what it is in a way prescient. And some people won't want to hear that, and that's fine. They don't have to. But you have been around the block, you know. And I also have this sense that we can't possibly know right now, outside of the speculative fiction type works, which are really helpful, I find, you know, like,
yeah.
And people, filmmakers like Jennifer Abbott, who did a film called The Magnitude of All Things. It's a fabulous piece about grief.
Oh, I need to see that.
Yeah. So actually, I'll play an excerpt of Jennifer, because I just love her thought on these things.
The notion of reality and the way we grasp reality as humans is so deeply subjective, but it's also socially constructed. And so, you know, as a filmmaker, and you know, this is relevant because I'm also a Zen Buddhist, you know, from both those perspectives, you know, I really try to explore what we perceive as reality, to untangle and figure out in what ways are we being deluded, and in what ways, you know, do we have clear vision? And obviously, the more clear vision we can have, the better actions we take to ensure a more compassionate, just, and sustainable, livable world. So I'm all for sort of untangling the delusion, while admitting wholeheartedly that to untangle it fully is impossible.
So we were talking about that idea that the arts will, I mean, will there even be the arts, you know, in a world where people are scrambling to live? Well, there have to be, right? We are artistic beings in the sense that we're expressive.
We're creative. We need creativity and imagination. So absolutely. I wouldn't, again, maybe this is also a very radical thing for me to say, and I'm just going to blame it on my Eastern Europeanness. But, you know, if there is a world of no, you know, snooty installations in art galleries, I won't be too sad about it. During the ecological crisis, that is.
Well, but the ecological, I mean, I've been thinking about this. I try to be objective because I love art, and I think you do too.
I love art too, absolutely. I go to the opera and I love art too, but I realize that it's a privilege. Yeah.
Well, there, and, you know, when you think also about imperialism and, privilege, and a lot of the issues that are intertwined in all of our lives, like, the arts are not neutral, right? They go either way.
Yes.
They help us. They manipulate us. Mm-hmm. Depending on the intention of the artist, and that also is not necessarily right or wrong. But one should not be naive that art is good and it will. And I'm a little bit naive that way because I do believe that art, in the broadest sense, in the sense of culture, which you talked about, artisans, yeah. however it's approached, not only plays a role, it's who we are and it's how we'll be able to work our way through the complex issues. Not necessarily by just going to the theater, although that can be good, but ourselves reflecting artistically and spiritually on the stories that we know, the things that we believe, the things that we feel. And if you can feel them, like you talked about earlier, feeding the pigeons, mm-hmm. listening to the sounds, it sounds, you know, a little lighthearted or whatever, but it's not. It's so deep. It's so deep.
It is.
It's who we are. And living with other beings, you know.
Living with other beings without, and really thinking about what does that mean? I mean, what I've been, again, as a result of the pandemic, just really humbled. I mean, the crow friend, our crow friend that just came by, and I just no longer think of any sort of separation between me and the birds, and in a sense of a hierarchy. Like, I don't think that they're unimportant and I'm important. I listen to that and I think this crow has, you know, is busy. He's got somewhere to go. He's doing something right now. He's calling. He's got other things. It's almost like a multiverse situation, you know? He's got other things going on, just like I have things going on, and my things are no more important.
The tree right there is growing at its own pace and its own rhythm.
Yes.
Somewhat oblivious to our anxieties.
Yeah.
Unless we cut it down, in which case it will be very anxious. But then yeah. it will have a brother or sister tree nearby. Well, it will have fed. And all of those interconnection pieces that are sadly not enough part of our culture.
Not enough part of our culture and part of our just enculturation. And just to roll it all back, I think I always remember the importance, and I think Schaefer really appreciated that, the importance of early education. I mean, that's where enculturation happens. That's where little humans, kids, learn how to think about themselves in the world. And that's where we need to convey those kinds of things to them, you know, that at best, we should think of ourselves as, you know, custodians or guardians in harmony with the world, not as rulers of the non-human world.
Well, to go back to the beginning of this conversation, you talked about you're teaching at SFU in the same place where Schaefer taught, and then Barry Truax
yeah.
and others. I'm writing a piece now about a piece that Schaefer and I did together in 1997 called The Winter Diary.
Mm.
And it'll be a future episode. I don't know which one, probably 100 or something, but by the time I get it done. But it was interesting spending time with him because he actually was very good at being in the moment. He had failings like other humans, but he is so perceptive and able to write about it, about what he's hearing and feeling.
Yeah.
And I feel that's been a gift to humanity, gift to the sound world, to have somebody articulate.
Yes.
And you know, some of it's a little old now. You know, you read it and you go, oh well, I would write it differently. But the ideas are sound, most of them. So I'm excited about that, building on his legacy, not me personally, but all of us,
mm-hmm.
both critically and picking up on the good parts, because there's such wealth there, and here in Vancouver. It's such a wonderful place, you know, to listen and to be artistically and with environment. So I'm just thinking that era in the early 70s of the World Soundscape Project, and you now continuing to teach from that base. What are you bringing to your students that today makes acoustic ecology alive today? You talked about that project you were saying in the urban. How do we keep it alive, I guess is my question.
Well, absolutely. I mean, read once a quote by David Kahn, which was quoted in Jonathan Stern's 2003 book, and the quote was something along the lines of, sound is not a destination, it's the start of a journey to other things. I'm misquoting, but you know, something along those lines. And so for me, really, it's that's the way that I want my students to approach it when we talk about livable soundscapes. Just the term livability has been so discursive, so ideologically used. Vancouver has been for a decade topping the charts of livability, and what does that really mean, and for whom, and how do we think of it? And so listening or sound is a way to reapproach that issue from a really lived experience. That's what interests me, and what's important to me is the lived experience, because the charts for livability are based on data, they're based on infrastructure, they're based on reported numbers of things, not lived experience. And one of the things that I'm most proud of, although I can't say that it's fully developed, but one of the ideas that I'm most proud of in this project is we've been talking about how to represent. Oh, and there's the noon horn. Did you hear it just now?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, it's noon.
Yeah.
Nice.
It's noon. We can hear all the way here. Yeah, it's very faint today because there is a bit of ambience, but
it's such a Vancouver moment.
It's such a Vancouver moment, yeah.
Well.
Yeah, it's such a WSP moment too.
You were saying?
So I was saying that this idea I'm so fascinated with is to try and represent sonically different listening positions. So we've been going around and recording, and I feel very torn about recording, doing field recordings. I think there's ethics. I think there's ethics that we need to think about, and I try to convey that as well, so that it's not extractive. And I'm really fascinated with the idea of trying to represent different listening positions, different something that would be differently significant to someone depending on who they are. Something alongside of what, you know, Dylan Robinson talks about with regard to sonic positionality. And Dylan is someone that we had a conversation, an open conversation with Case in the summer, which was really good. And so I very much think and try to convey the idea that that listening, starting with listening, opens up the possibility to tell the story of a certain perspective, and to then compare that with other perspectives and begin conversation, whether it's about economics or politics or urban planning or amount of green space or amount of quiet space or space for youth, space for seniors.
And what are some of the barriers for people developing better listening practices?
Well, I might sound like an old person, but attention span. I mean, people are on their devices. I do an exercise with students where I ask them to do a detox. That's become actually quite standard, not just in my class, but several colleagues do that. Ask students to do a detox, and of course we always get the story of like, oh my god, it's so hard. And I ask them to do a music detox, as in like background music that they listen to or playlists that they listen to that accompany certain activities, and oh boy, they dread it, they hate it. It's a constant soothing, that independence, it becomes an emotional dependence, and so that's a big barrier to being present and listening. Being present is scary, I think, for some of my youngest students.
And yet, if they were to experience a quiet moment or, you know, meditative, the word meditative is not so useful, but I'm a Zen practitioner, and so I've gotten used to silence or quiet, and I really enjoy it. And I also enjoy podcasts, and I run, and I listen to podcasts, and I love, you know, listening to Green Dreamer, or my favorite podcast, and people's ideas. But I try to find a balance. Now, I practice listening. Maybe people need to practice listening the way they practice other things.
And yeah,
You can get good at it.
Yes, yes.
And enjoy life quite a bit more, including music and all the background, but not just that sort of wall of sound media.
Absolutely. And that is where listening is synonymous with presence, really, for them. When I say them, I mean younger people. I think practicing listening really is practicing being present, and that is extremely important. I think presence, I think we can all agree that unless we are present and not always escaping, we're certainly not going to be prepared for the climate emergency that is happening.
That is happening. So, Milena Brumeva, I have to pronounce it properly, sorry. Is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you'd like to say?
I'm sure there is, but I think that's a good ending point.
Yeah, presence.
Presence.
Well, we can end in a way with, you know, I somewhat regret this backwards.
I know.
Sound, but I also think of it as an ocean or as a flame. You know, it is a flame.
yeah.
And you make choices, right? That's why I changed the microphone at one point. But I think it's where we were, it's where we are, it's where we were. And the listener will listen to your voice, but also the other parts.
Yes.
And they can come in and out of our somewhat rambling conversation. And that's maybe a way to live, you know, is to take bits and pieces and to say, that fire is a bit irritating to me, but I'm actually going to pay attention to it or not. I'm going to make that choice, but I know it's there. I enjoy the things around us and the choices that we make and the mistakes that we make.
Yes.
Like you and I should know better than that.
I know. I know. As a recordist, I always have that too, you know, that's not going to record well. But I try to interrupt that kind of thinking because it does, you know, it's kind of technically.
Yeah, but you're trying to be perfect,
minded,
right?
I
took up my microphone, put my little windsock on so that we wouldn't have the rumble. But I didn't think about that. I actually did think about it. I thought it would be nice. It probably is nice. Anyway, it is what it is. Thanks for your time.
You're very welcome.
We will keep in touch. And I appreciate the teaching you're doing because you're planting seeds in young people's minds.
I hope so.
And the word hope comes to mind as well. We need to leave a legacy of hope for life that will inevitably continue on Earth.
Yes.
It might be hard. It might be better than we think it will be, but we need to prepare for it.
Indeed.